What I've been asked to talk about tonight is reflexivity and what it means. We've been talking about it for some time, but we never bothered to say what it meant. Did any of you notice that? Yes? No? No. The next woman coming. So we're going to have another go at clarifying what it means. Now, I'll draw, first of all, a diagram to control our thought a bit. I hope. I want you to imagine that is the center of a circle, and another one would go here, and another like this, until we had seven. But I don't want to draw on the seven because it takes too long. I'll use up my talking time. There's another one. I'm leaving a little gap between those two, like that. Then I'm leaving another gap and doing the same thing, but this time can you see that? Is this all there? It's all there, yes. Right. I want to draw a line through here to represent an ocean of matter. Everything down here is matter. Do you mind if I take time to draw matter? Won't take very long. I'm going to put an 8 here to represent a principle of hierarchy, and an M in this matter to represent inertia. So we have a hierarchy based on initiative, that's the dot on the I. How many letter I's in the word initiation? Can you count? Four. Do you know another word in English with that many I's in it? Four levels of being and one I for each level. Now, inhibition. It's a good word, isn't it? How did you work that one out? Just came. So initiative and inhibition presuppose each other. Any more? Inquisition is what you get if you try to pass from initiation into inhibition without permission. If you're in the realm of inhibited being and you try to get out of it into the realm of initiative, you will go through the Inquisition. That's the structure of society. Now, if we counted these things, 1, 2, 3, 4 in the gap, 5, 6, 7, that would be to start with the material world, and we could equally well start in the opposite way. Like that, and that would be to place God first. There's a difference of opinion about this. There are certain people called members of the left hand who count from the bottom up in that way. But whichever way you count, the middle one, the four, remains the same. And we're going to write exactly what it means. I'm going to take the position of the God position and say will is up there. The will initiates a process of introjection. Remember that these are really circles which are centers. So this bottom one here is a periphery of a big circle, and that one is another one there. You can imagine all the other circles. So the seventh one is the central one of being. And the true center of initiation is within. Notice within, with and in. It is with itself, present to itself, and in itself. Can you complete the other circles, or would you like me to spend my time drawing them? I don't need to. Thank you very much. Now, the will initiates a process, but whatever it wills, it loves to will. So the second level is love. And whatever you love, you tend to activate. So I'll put an active there. I won't bother about the rest of the word because that's good enough. And you immediately see, whatever you have done in your life, whatever you have initiated, you've done it because you willed to do it. There were no constraints on you at first. A baby sitting in the womb, if it feels like changing leg position, does so. It doesn't telephone up mummy through central nervous system, may I move my left leg? It just does it. Mothers who've born children know that. And the love is generated by the will. And remember, love means working for the development of the potentialities of the being. Now, if you initiate something and then you charge it with love, it automatically goes into action. It develops itself in act. Now, that is true of the world here. And this world, remember, is inside you. And there has been a fall from the will there down to the bottom level. This fall is very simple. It consisted in turning the attention from the inside to become interested in the outside. Now that caused the will, which is essentially central, to go out to the periphery of being and start examining other beings. Inanimate beings called the world of objectivity, consciousness beings, the world of selves, and an absolute being, self, which cannot be touched because it is pure initiative. Nothing happens to it from outside. Everything it does is from inside. The fall occurred, you know the Genesis story about it, through extraversion of attention and desiring to taste the fruits of the tree of knowledge. Now, we're going to show the correspondence 1 to 7. So we're going to connect 7 and 1, 6 and 2, 5 and 3. And you're going to see if you like this analysis inside yourself. Now, as far as the material being is concerned, the one we call the fallen man, he believes there is nothing above him. His head is his intelligence, and he believes that his intelligence is truly his. It doesn't belong to anyone else. It's his intelligence. He presumes to argue with himself, there may be a God, there may not be a God, but I am intelligent. That much I know. So he doesn't know about this top level. And he's through the fall identified with his physical body. Now at the end of this body there is a letter T in Scottish masonry. The rabbi Burns. It is called the wee pickle tau. You know why it's called a pickle tau? It likes preserving itself. Now the fallen man thinks that his potency is his. He doesn't know that that potency is the will of the absolute for him to reproduce. If there are any old men in the audience, they're as old as I am. Let them examine themselves. Have you ever feared impotence? Don't answer. if you have, you've probably been proud when you weren't impotent. And if you were proud of it when you weren't impotent, you thought it was yours. You carried the banner, the Incredible Hulk. You thought it was yours, and when it was working well, you thought it was owing to your terrible power. Medically, it is claimed that no man can cause it to stand up for itself by effort of will, but it rises and it falls. Now, the belief that that power belongs to the man on whom it's only an appendage is a product of the fall. And what it does, whenever it sees anything whatever which it considers worthy of reproduction, worthy of keeping in the world, it goes forth from there, and we saw here is will, and apparently down here is will in that magical Tao. But if there is will in the magical Tao, it follows there will be love, which is correspondent with the love of the Absolute. Now, if you see gentlemen looking fit, like Mr. Universe I saw on TV recently, and if your feminine heart leaps and thinks there should be more of him, or if a man, and you see a curvaceous leg, and you think that's a good leg, worth Queen Anne's furniture, and you decide to keep it, you fall in love with the thing because it's functionally perfect. It could be the glance of an eye, even the colour of it. Some eyes are nice colour. Every time a fallen man sees something which is what he considers to be beautiful is really formally, functionally perfect, or near enough to it to pass for it. So beautiful hair, beautiful eyes, beautiful teeth, beautiful anything whatever. Formal perfection of function, functional perfection of form. Now the man who then thinks, I must chase that, and I must reproduce through it, is actually being used as a tool by the Absolute Will. I'll put the Indian term that there for you. That Absolute Will is called Shiva, and this last function is called Vishnu. And this active principle is called Brahma. Now that Indian Trinity is the same as the Father for Shiva, the Son for Vishnu, and the Holy Ghost for Brahma. Now Shiva is characterized by Ananda, that's bliss, because there is no possible way of him being impeded, because he is Absolute Will. Whatever he wills immediately operates. He's in a state of bliss precisely because he is in charge of himself, and he knows that he is Absolute Will, so that when he wills, things happen. What happened was, from the Absolute Will, a love of activation occurred, and the love generated the activation. The activation made the world of objectivity. I call the Brahma world the world of objectivity. All things that are objectively existent are within the Brahma world. And in the Vishnu world, the world of preservation, Brahma is creation of form, of objectivity. Vishnu is preservation of the same. In that world, you have J-N-A-N-A. Pronounce it how you will. It's cognate with the English word to know, and it means the world of consciousnesses. The Brahma world, the active world, is the world of objectification, the world of objective things. But the Vishnu world is the world of consciousnesses. Now, Martin Buber wrote a little book, I and Thou, and talked a lot about I-It. The realm of itness is Brahma. The realm of I-Thou-ness is Vishnu. But those two are polarizations of the Shiva. Let's consider very carefully. The characteristic of Shiva is bliss motion, motion absolute. But we are not to confuse motion with movement of bodies. Movement of bodies is an M function trying to develop through the V, MV, trying to develop out of the inertia, trying to break out of inertia into free creativity. You know, we would all like to be cleverer than we are. We would all like to have initiative and do marvelous deeds. But inertia stops us. The inertia is this M function down here. The inertia is materiality, and that is mass inertia, that is momentum of behavior. Now, you remember the story that we told of an Indian myth about an argument between Vishnu and Brahma about which of these two was the most clever, the most powerful. And Vishnu said, I am the preserver of the universe. And Brahma said, if I didn't create it, you'd have nothing to preserve. And Vishnu said, if you didn't have me to preserve what you created, it would vanish the moment you made it. And when they were arguing in this way, there suddenly appeared a fantastical column of light called the Shiva Lingam. That is to say, the wee pickle tower, which later appears in time, appeared in its infinity of brilliant power. Now I want you to imagine a phallus, and the word phallus means shining one. I want you to imagine this phallus to be extended in both directions equally. And she's going that way and she's going this way, and it is infinite. You can't see the end of it. And this suddenly appeared in the presence of Vishnu and Brahma and shocked them into silence. And then all the gods, the other gods, because there's an awful lot of gods about, said, this is astonishing. What is it? How long is it? And they all became very, very envious. So they said to Brahma, you go one way, and to Vishnu, you go the other way, and find out how long it is and come back and tell us. So they went off in opposite directions, and they traveled for ever so long, several thousand years. And Vishnu, who's an honest character, and I call him preservers, like Mrs. Thatcher, for instance. Preservation is conservation. And he got very tired of this thousands of years journeying, and he thought, surely there's no end to it. In any case, if there is, I'm not going to find it because I'm fed up. Because he conserves things, and to conserve is to go round, not in a straight line infinitely. So he went back and said to the gods, I didn't find the end of it. Meanwhile, travelling in the other direction with Brahma, he was travelling thousands of years in the same way. He didn't come to the end of it, and he was getting very annoyed. And he's creative, you know. He's got to create something. It's only a tall story. And just as he was thinking what to say about this, a butterfly came towards him, flying through the air like this, like butterflies do. And it was coming towards him, so it must have been coming from the other end of the Shivalingam. So he said to the butterfly, have you seen the end of the Shivalingam? And the butterfly said, yes, and went away. So Brahma immediately turned around and he went back to the gods and said, I have seen the end of the Shivalingam. Well, there's a bit of a row about that. So if you go to India, you do not find temples built to Brahma, because he told that terrible lie. There are temples to Vishnu, temples to Shiva, but no temple to Brahma, because he told that lie. The real meaning was that the butterfly coming towards him flies like this. He does that so birds can't catch it. It flies instantly with a change of direction. You've observed that with butterflies. They fly very erratically and unpredictably. So when the Butterfly said, yes, I have seen the end of it. He meant now. And Brahma didn't understand that, so went back and told this terrible lie. He'd seen the end of it. Now, infinity has no end, and the infinity of power, which is Shiva, that infinity of power is blissful because it is top power. There is nothing anywhere that can impede it. Now, how would you like to be an infinite power that nothing can impede? Well, if you're going to stay infinite, you will not create, will you? Because as soon as you create, you circumscribe. To create is to encapsulate. And that is to lock yourself up. Shiva stays in the infinite. And therefore he is in bliss. And there is a level before being, because to be is to be encapsulated. Before the letter be, before the be in Breshit, before the be in beginning, there is an absolute motion. But it's not a relative movement as of time bodies. It is pure, absolute motion, and because it cannot be impeded, it is bliss. It is Ananda, that bliss. Now, if you were in the state of Shiva, you wouldn't have this present body that you've got. If your bodies were to dissolve and be reduced to a non-contained motion, which transmitted itself immediately to infinity, what would you feel like? Well, would you be happy to do it? Haven't we got an instinct called self-preservation? If somebody runs at us with a car or a carving knife, don't we tend to dodge? Isn't there something in us that says bodies are quite nice as references? Where does the impulse come that says preserve your body? The answer is it comes from the will of the Absolute, from Shiva. He says, I want to play. And for play, I must have balls. I must play ball games. The primary balls he makes are what we call atoms. And then by juggling with the atoms, which he makes, each one a center of will, by the patterning of the atoms, he makes the universe. So in nature we have 92 elements, science has added a few, raising them to over 100. But these are the primary particles with which the absolute power is juggling and making the world. And each particle, considered on its own, is a monad. It's a one, and in the act of coming from the infinite, it has bound itself with love to be. It has put an L to bind it, and it's made an egg, an ovar, and it has been determined to develop it. And that monad, that oneness, is what you call your soul. Your very self-being, the pure self, not the empirical slave to the material body self, the pure consciousness. Now we have some other terms. If we put Ananda here, we have Sat down here, and we have Chit here. This makes a trinity. Sat means ST, means the crucified beings which have been created by the activity, the Kriya, of the Dharma function. And insofar as you have a locatable physical body of objectivity, you are in the realm of Sat. Satam, the same base as Sat, and Sit, and Stand. And that is the unconscious part of your process. It is mere objectivity. The chemistry of your body is mere objectivity. But suffusing the chemistry of your body, that is the chit function or pure consciousness. Now that consciousness can remain turning in upon itself and knowing itself to be consciousness. Or it can come down and identify with the body that is precipitated by the will of the Absolute. Now, those two are polarizations on the Absolute Motion. So Shiva polarizes as Vishnu and Brahma, which means that your will polarizes as love and activity. The thing you love is the thing you will try to activate. And at the level of the Absolute there, in pure power, that's called the Kingdom of Heaven, that's heaven, and this is earth, yeah? At the level of heaven, you have a hierarchy of powers in pure consciousness, and you know that your body, this very body that you have, this body is a precipitate of love, the product of an initiative act of will. And that being so, you see that what we drew in the first place was a man. The belly, the chest, then the little gap to the neck, then the head. But on earth the man stands, the belly is below, the chest in the middle and the head above. And the fallen man, who doesn't believe in this realm of free power, thinks his head is the highest. Now between these two is a fourth position. And the fourth remains the same whether you count from the top or from the bottom. Now let's imagine that a man who's fallen doesn't know he's fallen, and he stands on the earth and he says, I am a being of power, potency, I'm a being of sexual drive, I'm a being of appetite, of ambition, and I have my feelings, and my feelings are mine. I like this, I dislike that, and that's my business. And I think my thoughts, and those thoughts are my business. And I'm indebted to no one. They're mine, through properties of myself. Now that is called crass egotism, to believe that. The reality is, to the contrary, that all the seeds of potency, the 200,000 eggs that are in a little girl at birth, and the sperms that will be made and lost 2 minutes at a time by a mature man in a sexual relation, these things are not the work of the individual mind. The human being has not cracked the mystery of the head of the sperm or of the nucleus of the ovum. He doesn't know those things. He's no good pretending with his science and his microscopes that he has, because he has not. And any honest scientist knows that he's nowhere near cracking DNA as a cause of life. So, the fallen man is labouring under an illusion that his potency is his, that his feelings of like and dislike are his, and that his intellect is his, and he has control over it. But funnily enough, he says to himself things, I will do this, and I will do that, and he doesn't do this, and he doesn't do that. And then he makes excuses. He finds reasons. Impedances came from the world, from other people, from their ill will, from their bad motives. He never thinks to himself that his success belonged to the infinite power, that his will was a mere little tiny precipitate of the absolute will. He never thinks that his love is a directive from the absolute love of what to love. And he never thinks that his thinking is nothing but the thinking process of the universal creative mind. So he remains in subjection to a triple erroneous idea. I do my own thinking, my feeling, my willing. And all the time the reality is that he is being imposed on. If he sees beauty and wishes to reproduce it, it is the will of the Absolute saying, reproduce, that's a good model. If he thinks he likes something or dislikes it, it is the will on the Vishnu level saying, preserve it or get rid of it. If he gets an idea, like a triangle has three sides, and thinks that he knows that personally, and even worse, has invented it, is again labouring under another illusion, that his thinking is his own, and it is not. So we have to face here division. Now there is a solution to this problem. At point number four, there is a consciousness that can look both ways. Remember, to look upwards on this diagram is to look inwards to your center. To go downwards is to go to your periphery, where the stimulus comes from outside and obscures your process by the contingent attack from another being. Now, point four, you can actually become aware that your thinking process is not being conducted by your empirical ego awareness at all. Your thinking process is being conducted by laws of intellective motion. You can't help thinking that a piece of string is twice as long as half of it. If you try to get rid of that idea, it won't go away. You can't help thinking that a square has got four sides and a triangle three. You can fight it, but the idea is there. It is not generated by the empirical, egotistic, fallen man. He suffers that idea because it is imposed upon him from the universal awareness. Would you mind committing that diagram to memory for me now? And we're going to discuss some of the implications of that diagram. The top level, which is your innermost self, is the will. It is you as initiator. You do not have a will other than you, which you occasionally use and occasionally do not use. You essentially are will, in the same way that Shiva, God the Father, is the will of the Absolute. That same will is unimpeded and is therefore operative in the center of your own being. But immediately below the level of the initiating will, there is your love. Now the love of the Vishnu to conserve what it sees in the motions of the Shiva, that love causes the activation of the Brahma in you to try to fixate, as if a man getting an idea, I will do a picture. I've got the pigments, I've got the canvas, I will do a picture. Well, what will I do? I've got the will to do it. Now I must love something more than something else, so I can make my picture. So my love is selective. There's an infinity of possibilities, but love is selective. So when I've got my love, the next thing is I pick up my brushes and I start putting pigment on the canvas according to the dictates of that which I love, and that which I love has been posited by an initiating act of will. Now we are not to think that we have as a possession, like a thing you have in your pocket and you can take it out, put it on the table and go out in the car and forget it. You are not to think that your will is like that. You essentially are will. You are a quantum of will. That's the monad, the one. You are a quantum of will, and it is when you initiate that something happens. But if you say, like a man on the phone to me this afternoon, that I have no will, I need help, that's why I rang you up. So I said, no, it isn't. You rang me up because it's more economic to talk to me than to talk to you. And that was a fact. And he said, well, I heard you say that economy is a good thing. So he spoke to me for 1 hour and a quarter to get steam up. And at the end he said, thank you very much, I can now go and use my will. I said, you've forgotten. You are the will. You are not using your will. You are using your feelings and your body action possibilities at the behest of you the will. Fundamentally, you are will. Now you can easily see why in the ancient world governments did not like this idea being taught to people. If people were taught you are will, and you will select what to love, and then you will activate what you love that you have willed, well, where might they go for their holidays? Or where might they go if they go to work? How could you run a civilization? Babylon, Egypt, India, China. How could you run it if people knew that they were actually centers of free will? Could you do it? Could a man who knew that he was will tell everyone else who didn't yet know, the newly born babies, you say to the new baby, yes, it's your daddy in the eye, it's okay, you are will. And it's daddy's job to shift his eye out of the way of the fist. Daddy must not fall asleep, daddy must not rest on parental authority. He must rest in alertness. Now you all know that. Those of you with children know that your children are centers of initiative. And they're very hard to control. And you have to threaten them or remove the chocolate, or if you lose your temper, hit them, or lock them up in the bedroom or in the cellar if you have one. Anything to curb them and destroy their initiative. And eventually, if you are what is called socially lucky, they are conditioned and they become quiet members of society, and they go and do their job quietly in the sewers or on the trains or wherever, and they keep this marvelous mechanism of commodity services production that we call world civilization going. But if everybody knew that they were fundamentally will, and that will which they are, not something they possess that they can put away, but which they are, if they knew that and could select their own thing to love and then activate their love, they might go and play the ukulele instead. It's possible. I know a little Jewish girl who has decided to reintroduce the ukulele into modern music. Maybe you'll see her in 6 months' time on Top of the Pops. She's little enough and fat enough to command attention. But she does know she's will. And if she wants to love the ukulele, she will love it. And she will activate it. She can already play 3 chords. And you can cover most folk songs with those. Isn't that right, men? So, we have a situation in which we fallen folk have been conditioned, that is, have had conditions imposed upon us by concealing the fact that we are fundamentally beings of initiative, and that there is a rule called the moral law which everybody shall obey, and that this means you have a position in society which you shall keep and you shall not step out of it. The rich man in his castle, the poor man at his gate, God made them high and lowly and ordered their estate. All things bright and beautiful, the Lord God made them all. Now stay where you are. Happy low, lie down. Uneasy lies the head that wears the crown. Do you believe it? Do you like that Victorian morality? Well, for thousands of years, 6,000 written, and about 250,000 unwritten, people have been conditioned to believe their activities have got to be socially conditioned, their thought has to conform to that taught to them by their educators, and the will is a myth. There isn't one. Modern psychology says there is no will. It's a fantasy. There is reactivity to external stimuli, and there is wishing and wanting, but no initiative. Now, if you say to yourself, well, I'll examine that proposition. Did the man who told me that himself have no free will? Was he mechanically reacting to something to tell me that I have no will? Because if he was mechanically reacting to a stimulus, he could be wrong. Maybe I have a will. Now one of our tests for this is the position number four. That fourth position, we start with the belly of the fallen man on earth, the sexual drive, the food drive, and then we climb up to I like it and I dislike it, and then we climb into the head and we think. And then we have this initiative concept passed down by all the great religions. You are fallen, you are upside down, and there is another man. In the Tarot, there's a man called the Hanged Man, and he's upside down. And he signifies, like St. Peter, who was crucified upside down at his own request, he signifies there is another man, the opposite way up to us, whose activity of thought is creative. But his thought, that's the Brahma, his thought is the product of the conserving intention of the Vishnu love. And that is the product of an initiative act of Shiva, cosmic supreme power, unimpeded, absolute pure motion. Now, if this is true, we can sit in a certain position in our bodies and demonstrate it. Now, in the back of your eye, you have a retina on which there is an image. I'm looking at you. If I project my interest outside my body, I think I look down there and I see Ken there and Abel there, and it seems a long, long way away. I have to get off this platform, walk down there, perhaps 20 steps to get near to them. That is an illusion. The actuality is an image on my retina in my consciousness. And if I sit on my retina, I become aware I have a mind recognizing Ken and recognizing Abel. I can recognize them in my mind. What is this field of recognition, which I call my memory inside? Should I not sit in fourth position on the retina and say the things that I see outside that I recognize, know again, I've already got inside me in my memory, otherwise I could not recognize them. Isn't that so? Now do a little exercise. You can look at anything, you can look at a lamp or something around the place, you might even look at me, and then say to yourself, the image that I've got in my consciousness is actually on my retina. Now look at me and do that. Instead of saying I'm so many yards away from you, say this image is on my retina, and then tell me what happens in your consciousness when you do it. Have I got the same objectivity, the same externality? Can you feel it? You can feel a sort of loss of external objectivity, can't you? If you sit on the retina, you're already halfway to pure subjectivity. That is, you're moving backwards towards the center of will inside you. A center of will which is your true being. And you have willed outwards from that center to the retina, and then you've gone out with nothing but the will to see an object externally. And you have focused it, and you have sharpened it, and you have made it objective by your intention to have an objective world of things to manipulate. Now you can practice retinal sitting in that way. You then become aware that you are a twofold being. You're objective as to your physicality, like other bodies. You are subjective as to your awareness of that fact. The Vishnu awareness conserves the memory of the image and relates it to the present percept. And the Brahma activity, the actual energy transmitted along a nerve in order to focus, That energy creates the image you see, and that creation is come out of your love for objectivity. Now, if you take the objective fact as a real thing in its own right, independent of your will to see it, you have lost magic and you have fallen into the external world of things. And in the process of falling into the external world of things, you have become enslaved by that which you objectively believe is real. Do you see that it's very simple to fall? You simply look with interest. I'll have a look at Herbie's tie. Is that a polka dot? They're not as bad as they might have been. I focused it. I didn't only focus that tie, I focused 1932, when polka dot ties were in vogue before they vanished and they now come back. I remembered them. I called on Vishnu. Have I seen this before? Yeah. All the boys had polka dot ties in that year. And all the girls said, he's no good, he's not got a polka dot tie. And we left polka dot ties at that time. For mysterious reasons of amour, we go forth, and with our tie we charm ladies. The idea behind it was every little polka dot represents an ovum waiting for my attention. You believe it? Can you feel it, Harvey?
When I focus on it, I'm then conscious, you think, of much more free dealing, and I'm aware of depth of focus, and I see beyond.
And you're on the way to falling out of your will center, aren't you?
In two directions, yes and no. Reality behind the situation.
Yeah.
When I see it in depth. And I can lose that if I
see
it as more of a 2D
figure. When you flatten it, you put it back on the retina. Because on the retina, it's a 2D image, not a 3D projection.
But when you said put it on the retina, I saw the 3D effect.
That's because you were fighting to get it on the retina. You had to draw back from your 3D projection. On the retina, it's only got 2D. It's got height and width. It's got no depth.
I saw beyond you when I looked at
you. You were oscillating at that time. Yes. Trying to focus the effort producing a reversed effort. You focus, you don't focus. Now, when you can stabilize yourself on the retina, still see the external projection without loss of the retinal image, and then move behind the retina without forgetting the external world, you go to the center of your will to focus. Now, most people, as you know, like cats playing with balls of wool, forget that this is a ball of wool, not a mouse, don't they? They're captured by their own will to see something interesting to them. Now, what it means is this. We are little dots in an infinite field of motion. That's the Shiva field of motion. Our bodies are little compacted energy packets, little dots. Those little dots are points of impaction. The totality of all those dots makes up a colossal symphony. It actually makes sound. And the sound is a sound like the harmony of the spheres of Pythagoras. We are impacted, banging from infinity onto our centers like that. Each instant we contract, we exist. Each time we forget to contract, we don't exist. The mind wanders, and the mind is usually in a state either moving towards compaction when it's been insulted or hurt, or flying away because something else is more interesting than the present company. and we oscillate between being there and not there. But the art of yoga, meaning to conjoin, to yoke, is to get the innermost world, the Shiva world, and the outermost, the physical body of man, to be simultaneously co-present in the fourth level consciousness that looks both ways. Now you can try this in very, very many ways as an exercise. You can listen to a sound and then say, where am I hearing it? Is it really out there? Or is it in my eardrum? And am I remembering it? Am I recognizing the sound? Tonight they played some 400 Brahms. Do you remember the Brahms? If you knew it before, yes. When you heard the note, had you heard it before? Yes. It's stored in you somewhere inside the field of awareness. And when you go outwards and think, the music is outside, that is not true. There is no outside to the infinite field of consciousness. Can you see that's necessarily logically true? There is no outside consciousness. Every being that has consciousness, and only beings that have it know what it means, every being that has consciousness has never known unconsciousness. It's known a word called the unconscious. But that's a product of psychological theory. To know is already to be conscious, and no being has ever known the unconscious. He has known vaguenesses of feelings and of thoughts, ill-defined forms, but he's never known unconsciousness. The reason is there isn't any. Consciousness has degrees of sharpness of focus. The sharpest is represented by a dot, and the widest is represented by a plane of colour, with no edges extending to infinity. Now, if we then accept that our so-called will, which manifests as food appetite and sexual appetite, is really a precipitate of the will of the Absolute. It's the will of the Shiva, Creator, appearing in us and saying, if there's anything you see worth reproducing, go and reproduce it. Now we're going to have chaos if we follow this all the time, aren't we? Because you look around, there's something worth reproducing there, and there, and there, and there, and there. We're only one man, one woman. How can we get around and do it? So the great sages said, well, tell Shiva, when he says reproduce, I understand that the impulse of reproduction is from you, O Lord, but do you mind finding a substitute or a stand-in for me? And then you can release yourself from the necessity of eternal reproductive mechanism in the service of the Lord of the universe. But in order to do that, you must not be envious of other people doing the reproductive job. Now, how do we feel if we say to ourselves, we do not possess will like a thing that we pick up and put down. We are a power of self-motion. Now, a power of self-motion is called will. And the will unimpeded is called bliss. And the will that is intelligent is not impeded, because when it wills, it sees how to overcome resistances that may be presented. Now, in the word Ananda, you have a letter D, and D is a voiced consonant, and it means Dalat, a door. But it is an impedance, but it's an impedance that can be opened. The Ananananana, without the D, would represent an absolute motion unimpeded, but it would then be unaware of its power. So what it does, set up an impedance like a shut door, and then opens the door and goes through. And you know what happens if you get a gas passing along a tube, and the tube is made narrower, pinched in the middle. A certain thing happens to the velocity of the gas, doesn't it? What's it called, scientist? Venturi effect. If you've got a tube like that and then you pinch it in the middle and there is a fluid going along, when it comes to the pinch bit, it accelerates. Now translate the D in Anand as a Venturi pinch point. At that moment of passing through that narrow place, a door in the wall, specially made, consciousness accelerates and sharpens itself and becomes individuated. Now how do you feel if you know that only in a pinch situation, in an impedance situation, in a survival situation, do you start living at a higher level? Then you create pinch situations for yourself to accelerate your awareness. Can you remember any time in your life when you've been in danger? Didn't you wake up at that moment somewhat better than you were before? Have you ever fallen off a cliff or been nearly run over or nearly drowned or nearly electrocuted? Didn't you for a moment wake up? Weren't you vital at that moment? Wouldn't you like to live vitally like that all the time? But there is no way other than creating Venturi pinch doors. If you wish to wake up and vitalize, you have to find doors that are too narrow to go through and then go through them. Now, if you understand this, and to get back to the source power, which is pure initiative, there has to be an abandonment of the idea that the individual egoic being on earth in a physical body is itself its own creator. It has to see itself as within an infinite field of sentient, intelligent power, and the mode of that power operating for that power, being that power itself, that individual. Can you believe, sitting there in your chair, that you are actually God sitting there on the chair? Can you feel your divinity sitting on the chair? Can you conceive it? How do you feel if you say, infinity is pressing on me and making me do what I'm doing, and accepting it? If you accept what you're doing at any given instant of time as a precipitative act of the infinite sentient power, you are then entitled to call yourself a Muslim, because that means one who accepts. The Hebrew Muslim is the same word. Abraham was Muslim. He accepted that whatever he did was God doing it in his place, in that way peculiar to him. Now how do you feel if every act, every feeling, every thought that you have is divinity working in your individual place, in your individual way? Can you do anything stupid? Is it possible? Is it? No. Only if you forget that. Because
a cat wouldn't dream of going through a space that it couldn't get through in Venturi.
A cat? Well, a cat has grown whiskers to stop itself going through places too narrow, hasn't it? But hasn't it made whiskers to test the hole? And doesn't it know that it could get through with a squeeze or it couldn't? And if it does, it likes getting through, doesn't it? And if it can't, it wags its tail in fury and goes and looks for another hole. And it doesn't like going through a too wide hole, otherwise it wouldn't have grown whiskers to test it, would it? Now a wise man is like a cat with whiskers. He looks at the all-embracing power of the lady he's fallen for. He calculates whether he can get through it and out the other side. And if he thinks the grasp is too strong, he recommends his friend to take it to dinner instead of him. And passes the job over, by Shiva's permission, to his best friend. Did you never hunt in pairs? No. You miss great fun, fella. There's a kind of girl we used to call Stuma when I was a boy. Now, Stuma was a girl that was stewing with sexual, unused energy. She was in her early teens, and she didn't know what it was she wanted. And she was so wrapped in this energy, she couldn't say yes, and she couldn't say no. It used to be a song, she couldn't say yes, and she couldn't say no. Now, when you went out hunting in pairs, if you saw a stuma, you hoped that your pal was stupid. And he said, my God, she's nice, and you took the other one. Now, that's the same as the cat with whiskers. You put yourself in dangerous situation, but not dangerous such that you'll come out dead if you come out at all. You get the idea?
No, really, no, because
you always hunted alone. You had nobody to farm off your stumas. You got to be near it, haven't you?
You only be aware of things by comparison.
By comparison, yes, of course.
So if you know about venture, right?
Yeah. You know all about it. You know whether you can get through a given tube. A friend of mine was actually born through a hole in a contraceptive. True. That person has got lots and lots of drive and focus. You see? Reluctantly.
It's better now
if
it's more possible
to make a thing. Oh, I see. You know more about those than about cats, do you? One of the notes.
Because the
two
at night is a very positive living, not because the cat's whiskers and the whole for the French is.
Why are you so nationalistic? Why are you so nationalistic? I hate racism.
Well, what
do
you call it?
I call it a contraceptive. That's not nationalistic, is it? All right. And you think that it's a very, very small cat in one of those bags, and it had whiskers, and the rest are trying to get out too. Wouldn't you rather risk it than sit there with the others considering? You know that they're considering sperm, and when a fellow can't have any children, he goes to the sperm count, they put them under the microscope, and a lot of them are going around like this considering. The considerers don't get born. And the considerers in life don't get very far either. They are given posts of deep consideration in the government. They're not the ones that do the private land deals, you know. The essential thing is this, to realize that what we think is our will in the fallen state is a wish, a want, a desire, a reaction to a stimulus. But real will is initiative, unconditioned, and is nothing but the absolute God inside the incarnate being. And then what happens? Where are you if that is true? Is there anything you can't approach? Anything you can't try? What?
The impossible.
Name it.
No, it's
named by a will to name. And the impossible is that which is inherently, by definition, self-contradictory, like a square circle, square triangle. Those things, the logic of which are automatically cancelling out, those are impossible. But if a thing does not, by definition, cancel itself out, it is possible. Now, how do we feel if we're actually to take this seriously? We are here, sitting in our bodies, sitting here, by the will of the Absolute. And what we call I, when we say I, the real I is not the empirical ego, which is a concept structure built into us by our parents and educators, but it's the very center of reflexivity of self-sentient awareness. How do you feel it? You know, you're looking out of your windows of eyes like that, and that the eyes were introjected from the Absolute in order to see out through the body back into the infinite. You can see in the night sky stars thousands of light years away, and the power that sees them is the power beyond the stars that posited the human being and gave it eyes in the evolutionary process to look through the eyes to look back to the infinite. And that is reflection. In the same way that if we stand on point four between these two worlds, the outer and the inner, and look both ways, we see that they reflect each other. The incarnate self is reflecting the Absolute, and the Absolute is throwing back the message from the incarnate self back into the time process to keep it going. The balance is happening. Can you feel the possibility of doing it? Do you like the feeling when you contemplate doing it? If you've got it, nobody outside you is your boss. You are. And you are intelligent. You're not reactive. You don't react to stimuli. If you know that the stimuli are there to trap you into further slavery, you sit on point four. What other people? There aren't any. If you are an infinite field of awareness, that Shiva, then supposing I identify with the extended consciousness now, that body from which those words came out is just another of my bodies. And this body is another of your bodies. Where are the other people? There aren't any other. There aren't any other people. That's another illusion set up by governments. Other people are the wicked Russians, or the imperialistic Americans, or the damn awkward Nicaraguan government. That's other people. It's a fabrication. There aren't any. Think of all the cells in your body. And your body is constituted of cells. And an ignorant, egotistic cell would say the other cells are other to it. And it wouldn't know that it was part of a colossal organism, would it? And so it would kick the cell next to it and try to destroy it. He's coming along, I'm eating bacteria, I'm a phagocyte in the bloodstream, and that damn other phagocyte is going to eat that bacterium as I wish to have. So I'll kill that bacterium. Now, how much health would we have if we were such a mass of contradiction? An advanced schizophrenic is like that mentally. Every idea destroys another idea instead of cooperating with it. Are ruled by the intelligence of the Lord of the Universe, by the Shiva. But in the case of fallen man, he thinks he's got to kill every other man in order to live. We're running towards a war that's going to cut the population down seriously by frying large numbers of them. There's no doubt whatever that's going to happen, because of silly people who think their safety depends on the annihilation of others. The Americans are terrified of the Russians, the Russians of the Americans, both of them of China, China of both of those. We're in the middle of it. We have a possibility of being number four. By balancing the claims of those now superpowers. The universe hasn't fallen. Man has fallen into an erroneous idea that he can't survive without killing other men. The cells in your body have not fallen into that error yet. But they can do in certain types of schizophrenia and in certain types of very, very bad treatment to children. The children, by contrary orders from contrary parents, can get contrary emotion patterns, behavior patterns in them that fight in the child, so the orders of the mother and the father can tear the child to pieces. And if you're lucky and got four, namely parents and grandparents, giving you contrary advices in four directions, you can finish up under care. Not because your cells were fallen, naturally from within, but because you've been imposed upon from without by misdirections. The individual man has fallen to interest in external stimuli. He has placed his life at the mercy of the thing with which he has identified. It says Eve saw the fruit, was nice to look at, tasted nice, and would confer power like God. So she ate it. It doesn't. External knowledge does not confer power like God. Internal knowledge does. But internal knowledge does not try to destroy the self-determination of the sense of another individual. The person who tries to control other people from outside is just a demiwit, because you cannot control the center of another being. The center of another being is God. Nobody can control it, not by brainwashing techniques or any other method. So the man who thinks he can impose opinions and so on other people is deceived, self-deceived. If he tries to do so, he will fail. And he will then curse other people, because in his universe there are other people, and he is one of the other people to the other people. So there is war. In the next war, what are you going to do? Are you going to be shooting the next door neighbor so he doesn't use your shelter, like many of the Americans are preparing to do now? Or are you going to say, come in and fry with me in comfort? Now, if you can say, come in and fry with me, it's a bit more intelligent. Suppose you get surrounded by neighbours at the moment of blast off. The outer ones will get fried more than the inner ones. But the inner one was the one with the initiative to say, come and gather around me. That's called dialectic. You've seen a deer running away from a lion. They all tried to get in the middle. It's the outer ones that get eaten. And great intelligence says, I am kind. I love friends. Gather round me, gather round me, gather round me. How many millions of people are there around Billy Graham? So at a meeting, can you get at him? Not very easily. The bodyguards and secretaries. You can't ask a personal, direct question face to face. The bodyguard will stop it. And put yourself on center. From inside, look at your retina, see the image of what is there. Don't go out, but just look at that image. And say, I'm projecting the image by my interest. I could see anything. You know, some people that are called mentally ill, they project. They see figures called hallucinations that are not there, say the others, but they're quite there to the one that sees them. And you can have haptic hallucinations too. You can go up to one of these ghosts that you project and shake hands with it, and it will steal your wristwatch while you're doing it. And who we got? As sure as it's a poltergeist. The whole universe is called illusion or Maya, not because it doesn't exist, but because it does exist as a projection of the will. Maya means a firm appetite, your substantial activity, that kriya, that creative formulation process is an act of will. We're all here in bodies by general agreement. None of what we see, we agree to see. And if we didn't agree, we wouldn't see it. You've worn something. I see the colour of it. You chose it. I agree to see what you've chosen. I could go awkward on you and say it's pale green. Couldn't I? And with terrible power and intent to annoy you, I could actually hallucinate. And if you became weak or I got you drunk, you'd look down and it would be what I said it was. That's called magic. It's simply the imposition of one will on another. But you can't do that unless you catch the imagination of the person. And if they're not greedy, you can't catch their imagination. A person that's not greedy for something cannot be deceived. No reality really. The word real is made of R and L. The R means to discriminate and the L means to synthesize. The R, analysis, the L, synthesis. Reality is nothing but the multitude of wills that there be something. We're willing that we're here tonight. We're all in agreement about that. That's why we're here. Anybody disagrees, they get up and walk out. We're conniving with each other to keep the universe going. How do we feel about that? We actually connive with each other. Some of you are girls and some of you are boys. That's a fantastic lie. We're all hermaphrodites. But hermaphrodites don't play together as well as polarized heterosexuals. You know that? Funny that. So there's agreement. You've got it, I'll take it. It's a real agreement. Can you believe that everything is like that? Every single idea we've got, we've connived together to believe in it. Can you believe anything except your own will to believe? Now that mysterious word, J-N-A-N-A, cognate with our word to know. I want you to do a figure of eight and write N-A there and N-A there. And then I want you to put one of them inside your skull and the other outside. And the letter J means to affirm. So you're saying, affirm, snake, snake. Now this is going to really be a problem for you. Every person has two snakes. One on the inside and one on the outside. One is called the will and the other is called the intellect. And that word is translated knowledge, wisdom, love. Now when you're relating to any other person, do you believe that what they are saying they really mean? Or are they giving you an acceptable version for you? And in the coffee morning jargon, don't you actually find that people have quite different variants of the same story for each other? Everybody is a nana. They've got an internal process. They're not telling you what's in that process. But they're assaying your reactivity and giving you an acceptable version for you. It won't be the one they give to your mother or your father or your boyfriend or your girlfriend. It'll be the one they deem acceptable to you. And if you remember that, you can be an Arna too. But most people, 95% of people certainly, do not know that they are Arnas. You know, they actually believe what they say outside. And they go about adjusting to their own stupid statements. And they're tied up with them. How do you feel about that? Have you ever said something and thought, what the devil did I say that for? I put myself on the spot. I think I'd better ring up when I get home and say that's not quite what I meant. Correct the other Nana's viewpoint. And then the word banana means house of Nana. So they mind you. And you know, bananas are not fit to eat until they're rotten. You know what that means? It means until you have broken down its form and assimilated its power, it's no good to you. What do you do when you eat a banana? You chew it up. I assume you feel it. Hopefully you squirt hydrochloric acid on it and other rubbishes. You destroy its pure bananas and reduce it to energy. And then with your own will, you steal that banana energy and do something with it. Only because you are banana. You're a house capable of converting fundamental appetite, which is symbolized as a serpent, the Na. And the great king who knew that in ancient India was called Naga. And his incarnate snake. The guy's incarnation. The one who knows that he has this double process. He's aware of what's going on in his own brain. He's aware of the version of what is going on in his own brain that he's giving to the listener. And the fellow said to me the other morning, well, how do I know whether to trust what you're saying? You might be conceiving something from me. Could be. You'll have to go back to your own hour and find out. It's you that wants examining, not me. Supposing each one of us examines our own self, we will discover the inner Nama. And once we've got used to that and assimilated that, will we think that we've taken advantage of another Nama on the outside? No, you left me awake. You're in a universe of serpentry. How do you feel about it? You are the living God. Sitting on a chair in the body, the body's been interjected, thrown in towards the center from the Absolute, and the Absolute is in charge. And whatever you do or feel or think is by divine permission. How do you feel about it? You like each other?
No.
You're not a Muslim. Why don't you like each other?
More
favorable after
present
events. I'm sure it is. How many years have I known each other?
About 20
years. During that time, has our basic discussion not been about the danger of empirical egotism?
It's been like that all the time.
All the time. And it's still with us. Yeah, but consider, Shiva says that you have not yet finished your investigation of empirical egotism. It is he who is making you dissatisfied with the idea that it is he. You're okay? You're a Muslim. Suddenly you're converted. You have absolute permission to carry on being merely relative. Okay? You can do anything, whatever, no matter how stupid it is. It is all capitalized on by the cosmic intelligence. Just go and make a mistake, it's lovely. I enjoy them. It's the way you wriggle getting out of it. The dance of Shiva. The dance of the Mata Hari. Right, so we're going to think about that now. Thank you.